Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. This week seems to have gone even faster than usual. And as snow falls over the countryside, we are just 3 weeks away from Christmas. That's right. 3 actual weeks away from Christmas Day. The shopping hordes are already out in force, queuing up for bargains and braving the cold, but it's not really beginning to feel a lot like it, is it? Not for me, anyway. We've been veering from euphoria to despair at the announcement of a vaccine breakthrough this week, which it turns out doesn't make you immune from coronavirus, and neither does it stop you from spreading it to other people. Today we've learned that it might not stop you from self-isolating either. Well, we'll be asking Professor Carol Sikora what the point of it all is then. First up, though, we're talking Brexit with former MEP Alex Phillips as France last night threw a spanner in the works of negotiations for a deal. They're now threatening to veto what they're calling a bad deal over a row about fishing and a level playing field. Shouldn't we just be calling it a day now? After all, the only reason France has given access to the waters around Britain to fish them to death is because we gave them to them back in 1973. Seems an awfully long time ago. I mean, why would you keep any other agreement that you've had in place since 1973 without looking at the efficacy of it? We'll be finding out. 0344 499 1000. The Irish aren't too happy about it either. As Julie Hartley Brewer said, they appear to have been thrown under the bus by the French. We are heading up to Sheffield later on for a trip to the shops with Claire Bailey. And then it's down to Brighton with travel podcaster Lisa Francesca Nan, who's going to explain the latest Grant Shapps rules on high-value business travellers and others who have been told they can now go where they like. How does that work exactly? Plus, we'll be asking rail expert Christian Wolmar why Crossrail is paying 140 drivers over £60,000 a year for a four-day week before they've even finished it. Apparently, they need to test the tracks. What, with 60 people? Are you having a laugh? 0344 499 1000. It's Friday, of course, so it's another sparkling episode of the Perrier Awards, an homage to my brilliance in broadcasting. I don't think I've made that many mistakes this week, so we shall see what Marta Malagon has come up with in her company later on. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, on the fastest growing radio station on the planet. It is, of course, Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Now, it will come as very little surprise to most of you that when you wake up some mornings, you read a headline that says, EU blocks talks at 11th hour. Now, that could have been a headline that you would have read a year ago. It could have been a headline you read the year before that. Could have been a headline you read even 3.5 years ago, after, of course, the referendum in which we voted to leave the European Union. As Julie Hartley Brewer said, she's just happy that Boris Johnson's managed to get that particular thing over the line. But we still wait to see exactly where that line will end up being drawn. Let us talk now to Alex Phillips, political commentator, former Brexit Party MEP. Alex, a very good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm all right. I've just been sort of reading through what the French are banging on about, and it doesn't seem to be all that different from what they're always banging on about, which is that they want our fish and they're not prepared to stop fishing until they've run out of fish.
Right. Yeah. I mean, look, we've had arguments taking place over the English Channel since as long as our two countries have existed, frankly. Mm. But what I don't want people to do is get too attached to the fishing thing. Look, it is a very important industry to us. I think it's absolutely right that we have our seas taken back under our complete control. We've got some of the richest fish stocks in the world, which is why the EU are so hell bent on having access to them and securing what they think is their fair of our quotas. But if we get too caught up on this, we're being distracted from all the other big concessions that are taking place right under our noses. We learned this week that we're staying in the ECHR, which means courts in Strasbourg will still have precedence over our courts to determine whether or not people can be deported and all those topics you constantly see making the headlines. We've already done things like offer them absolute financial equivalence in the City of London. We no longer have that leverage over a deal. 75% of our economy is via the service industry. That's not even on the table when it comes to the negotiations of a free trade agreement.
But are you sure about the European Court of Human Rights, though? Because, I mean, we've been told that that's a sellout that's already been sort of done behind the scenes, if you like. But we have yet to see absolute and utter evidence of that, haven't we?
Well, no, this is the other thing, of course. We're yet to see an evidence of anything. And by the time this deal goes through, I still think it will, which I predict will now be over the course of the weekend, because it really has to be done really by Monday. We're left with such limited time. We're now talking a matter of weeks before the end of the transition period. And it's going to be about 1,500 pages of really intense legalese that politicians should utterly scrutinise before giving assent to this. And we saw what happened last time. Boris rushed through the withdrawal agreement. He annexed a constituent country of the UK to a foreign power to the extent we can't even send food from one part of the UK to the other. So, you know, this is about our entire nation's future. How are our politicians supposed to be able to pore over the detail and decide whether this is a good deal or not before giving its approval in that time? I don't think it can happen. And I am now terrified that what's going to come back is a fudge. Like I said, the concessions that have been made already cannot be undone. They're in that withdrawal agreement. And frankly, you know, Brino basically is the best we can hope for at this point. I'm glad to see that we're getting free trade agreements through. I think I read this morning that 54 have been made between Britain and third countries. And no, we don't need absolutely 100% a free trade agreement with the EU, down to our trade deficit and so on and so forth. I would argue it's more in their interest than ours. But let's not constantly keep focusing on fishing, because what will happen in the end is Boris will come back and say, Yarbu sucks. We've taken our Coquille Saint-Jacques back off the French. Macron can't make bouillabaisse anymore. What a victory for the UK. And the big issues, the major concessions will actually be hidden under the radar, and that alarms me.
But I'm a great believer in a fudge in these circumstances, Alex, and I'll tell you why. Because you can't really make allowances for absolutely everything. I mean, we've seen that with COVID, haven't we? Every time they try and come up with some new rules, they get caught up in their own feet, you know, because there's so much questioning of every single thing that then is examined in its minutiae detail that, you know, if we try and absolutely, you know, copper bottom absolutely everything that we talk to Brussels about, it will become a never-ending kind of nightmare, because there'll always be something else to negotiate. And I think the negotiations will continue. And it's the principle of leaving, I think, that most people in the country who voted to leave care about. And whether or not it's not exactly as we would like it to be, we just need to leave.
Yeah, look, I'm not one of these purists when it comes to every single detail of Brexit, because I think sometimes Brexiteers have a tendency to want to demand 100% of everything. And that is not how anything goes in any negotiation or any arrangement. And it is sensible to actually have an amicable and profitable relationship with our nearest neighbour. But at the same time, we're talking about an international treaty here. We're talking about laws that will affect my life, your life, the future of all of the businesses in this country for many, many years to come. And that is not acceptable, to just throw something through Parliament. Like I said, it would have been absolutely unthinkable previously for any UK Prime Minister to essentially say about Northern Ireland, you now have a completely different set of laws governing you to that of the rest of the UK. And as a result, we may no longer be able to send food from mainland Britain over to you without huge customs and tariffs. That, to me, is utterly unconscionable. That's already taken place.
Yeah, but I'm not sure how that's going to play out. And I don't think anybody is. I mean, look at the Irish situation. I mean, as you know better than anyone, having spent some time in Brussels not that long ago, in the end, Ireland have been thrown to the wolves, just as every other country has been thrown to the wolves by the EU if they step out of line. You know, Ireland are now saying they're going to try and fight to the death to make sure that the deal is good for everybody. But they're actually in all likelihood, the ones who are going to lose out here.
Well, yeah, potentially. But look, I mean, the EU have weaponised the Irish border since the start of these negotiations, and they've done that quite willfully, quite tactically, and very deliberately. And we have known this from the outset, and we've allowed that to take place. You know, if we had been adamant about our red lines from the beginning and said we want to leave on these terms and it's our way or the highway, we could have put in place all of the things we need to make sure that we'd have a transition to that, towards our brand new sovereignty and freedom. And the government have done nothing. We haven't been building up our fishing fleet. We haven't started testing and implementing technology such as MaxFAC, which is essentially creates borderless or infrastructureless monitored borders between two countries. I mean, look, the longest unmanned border in the world is between America and Canada, and they are happy to trade with each other and have different terms without the idea that things are going to suddenly require barbed wire fences and police checkpoints. And this is what the EU has constantly alluded to. We've allowed ourselves to be outplayed from day one. Now, a big part of that is down to Theresa May's legacy and what she brought back from Brussels, which was just utterly horrific. And then Boris Johnson's desperation to get anything, something through Parliament to claim a big victory. But it will be a Pyrrhic victory, because what he has done is already set the trap for future negotiations. And I don't really see now how we're going to walk out of this without some degree of damage in the future.
Yeah, you may be right, but I'm more optimistic than you are. But that's partly because, you know, here I am at the centre of everything in London and you're stuck in Gloucester in tier three. But I don't want to make too much of that.
I'm not in tier three. I'm in tier two.
Oh, are you? Okay, then. So yeah. Here's the thing. I mean, as far as doing the deal is concerned, you know, the one thing I think that Boris Johnson needs to do for his own kind of a legacy, if you like, is to get a successful Brexit, because at the moment that's the only thing he can really cling on to as a success, because at the moment everything else is kind of falling apart around him. And I think he'll be driven by that, and I think he'll be driven by that by the MPs who sit behind him, you know, who were part of the European Research Group, and the people who are more hardline than he is perhaps on the whole situation. So I think by the end of this weekend we'll have reached another milestone, at least, even if it's not set in stone.
Well, look, you know, you might be right, I think, on the fact that I do think that Boris probably does want to have a Brexit that's going to satisfy Brexiteers, even though I'm not convinced it's really part of his own ideological infrastructure. You know, this was the man who waited until the 11th hour to decide which side of the fence he was on for his own personal advancement. So let's not suddenly assume that he is a full, you know, committed Brexiteer to the bone. But like I said, so many concessions have already been made and people aren't talking about that. And it essentially shackles us to a deal that isn't going to be great for this country, because we've given over all the leverage we had apart from the fishing card. That's basically all we've got left. And the other thing is, if this deal is announced over the course of the weekend, there's apparently going to be about a 48-hour window before anybody gets to see the text of the deal or learn the detail of it. That's 2 days for Boris to run around and say, fantastic, oven ready, it's all solved, we've got Brexit done, you know, use his incredible oratorical skills to convince the country that everything is brilliant, try behind the scenes to whip MPs and then force them to vote on something essentially almost blind. Because like I said, I cannot see how stringent legal analysis of 1,500 pages of legalese can frankly be done even in weeks now. And so, you know, the people always talk about how the 11th hour really suits the EU and how they like running things down to the wire. I think in this instance it suits Boris Johnson, because just the same as the withdrawal agreement, it allows him to operate in the dark, turn around and tell everybody that he's had this incredible victory, get the whole nation excited, we got Brexit done, oh, we're going to put up bunting, we're going to have an independence day, whatever it is he comes out with to sort of warm our cockles, it's not necessarily going to tether to the truth of what is in that document.
No, but isn't it the truth as well that in the end it's not going to be as big of a deal as a lot of people will make it out to be? Because let's remember, most of the people who go on about what are you going to do about this and how is this going to be covered and what about that border over there and what about when we try and import this over here, it's mostly the Remainers who are concerned about what's going to go wrong. When in fact, you know, since January the 31st, we haven't really had any major problems dealing with the European Union. Of course, people will say, oh, well, that's because we haven't left yet. But that's what they're always going to say. You know, in the end, I think we can coexist with the EU as a separate entity outside of it, and nothing much will actually affect my life or yours. You seem to have frozen, I think. But that's basically the bottom line for me.
I don't know what your bottom line is, because I did indeed freeze. I think I'm still partially frozen.
Okay. I think that our daily lives will not be impacted all that much by any of this. You know, the people who've moaned about what's going to go wrong and how terrible it all is, you know, these are the same people who told us when the European Medicine Centre was going to move across back to Europe, we were going to lose control of our medicines, we were going to lose control of all of our pharmaceuticals, it was all going to be terrible. That didn't happen. You know, every warning that comes about something terrible that's going to happen if we don't do it right has never come to pass.
Right. No, but also you've got to remember that we've been in a transition period, which means absolutely nothing has changed in the last, you know, well, in the last 11 months. We're still essentially a full member of the EU. The only thing that's happened is we've technically left the European Union. But I'm not afraid of some apocalyptic scenario, whatever comes to pass, because we're talking about tariffs. Yes, they can be an inconvenience. They are not ideal. Often those costs can be handed down to customers. And it wouldn't necessarily be coming at a great time during a pandemic where there are so many relief schemes and other things that the government can put in place to offset those charges. And also, even if you look at the tariffs under WTO schedules, they're not eye-watering. We're not going to suddenly be paying 50% more for this or 70% more for that. And it works both ways. These things are built upon reciprocity too. So what is good for the goose is good for the gander. And the EU's not going to want to essentially cut off the nose to spite its own face either. So I don't think there's going to be a cataclysmic falling in of the sky, but it does alarm me, given it's been 4 years since that historic vote, that the government have done utterly nothing to tell businesses what it is to expect and how to prepare, because they've allowed these conversations to drag on to the very final minute. And if you're going to do something as bold as say, right, that's it, we're going to go for absolutely nothing, no deal, zilch, zero, you would have expected that could have been the position from day one, and a lot of preparation could have been made in order to make that work swiftly and smoothly. None of those things have happened. We're in the 11th hour. We don't know what's going on. The text isn't going to be analysed. We've given away too much already in the withdrawal agreement. And all I'm hearing every day is fish, 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 fish. The fishing industry is important. Yes, it is. But what about the other detail? Frankly, I think staying in the ECHR is equally as important when it comes to our sovereignty and our ability to make laws that benefit our country and are bespoke to us. And I, for all of those bits of evidence I've just put forward, in what world do you think Boris Johnson now is going to walk away with a Brexit deal that's going to be 100% in our interests? I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, well, you're very pessimistic, Alex. I don't know what's happened to you, but I'm very optimistic. And I'll tell you this, I think the bottom line for me is that we are already in a situation where very few businesses in this country even do business with the EU. You know, the vast majority of businesses in this country sell their products around the world, and very few of them actually only deal with the European Union. And so it's not really that necessary to prepare that many businesses for what's going to happen, because in the end, it's not going to affect that many businesses.
And look, there, like I said, there's many schemes and devices and offsetting elements that the government can put in place to ensure that businesses have a smooth transition to whatever happens in the future. And we are one of our biggest trading partners is America, and we've never had a free trade agreement with them. So, you know, this whole sort of panic over how important it is to be essentially tethered to the single market and therefore tethered to the regulations and rules of a political bloc, it's quite spurious, really.
Yes.
And look, I share your optimism to some degree, because I hope that whatever outcome happens, once you begin that process of divergence, all of a sudden people with their hands on the tiller get excited about all the new regulations and laws they can put in place. I mean, we found out today that the UK has finally banned live animal exports, something that Brexit has essentially enabled us to do, because it's something that the EU has never done. And there's always, look, when people say you can deviate even as a member state, well, to some degree you can. But the point is, there's an expectation of harmonisation. There's an expectation that you do things in lockstep with your partners in the EU, which is what's held them back with approving the vaccine. Any member state could have done what we did and gone ahead and approved the vaccine, but it's a tacit understanding between member states that they all wait to do it simultaneously and in chorus. So I think that we're already seeing some Brexit dividends which aren't being spoken about. And my hope actually is, once the process is underway and we've got sovereignty back and repatriated competences, then there will be a push to keep repatriating more, and the direction of travel is towards more diversity. But what matters here is whether that trade agreement will allow us to do it. Because if we stay under the jurisdiction of the ECJ, for example, we're not going to be able to continue that process of divergence easily. We're going to be held back, shackled, and forever kept in essentially the orbit of the single market, of the customs union, and therefore to some degree managed by it without any representation at the table.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a bit like saying when you get divorced, you know, the ex-wife still has some control over what you do, only if you let them at the end of the day. And in the end, I think it's a state of mind what we're about to do. We leave the European Union as a state of mind, and that way you're no longer feeling as though you're tied to the apron strings of these people who don't want you to do anything that they don't want you you to do. And I think that's where we will go. And that's the journey that we've been on since January 31st. And that's why I think the journey starts to begin to end this weekend.
Yeah, well, look, I hope you're right. And I think there is a degree of it being a state of mind. But when it comes to legal texts and international treaties, it isn't a state of mind. And that we've seen this over years and years. Let's take the ECHR, for example. As, you know, when you suddenly have a situation where you can't deport foreign criminals because of arguments at courts in Strasbourg over rights to human life, where you can't tackle terrorism on your own soil because of those restrictions imposed upon you. Yeah, it, ideally, we could break international law and say Yabu sucks, stuff you, we're deporting this person anyway. But if international law has absolutely no relevance or no bearing, the entire global system would start to fall apart. And the point is, if you start contravening international law and breaking it on a regular basis, you actually lose the trust and faith of yes and no, rogue states largely do.
Well, Germany does it, for example. Germany does it all the time.
The EU does to a greater or lesser degree, but largely breaks its own treaties. But I think that what we're looking at is the UK doesn't want to become, and that there are so many, it opens up the possibility of legal challenges, which would be wading constantly through a quagmire of waiting for the outcomes and judgments. And I think you'd find if we stay in, you know, under the jurisdiction of the ECJ, as we are going to do the ECHR, that a huge amount of our ability to self-determine how we run the country will have already been handed over. And yes, it'd be great to say a state of mind, we can just ignore those things and break it. But in practice, that doesn't happen. And also, you need a government prepared to do that. Future administrations of this country, who might be a lot more sort of pro-EU and wanting to get us back into the orbit of the EU, will use any single loophole that's been created, any single bond, any single connection that we still have with the EU to draw us back into that. So I think it is important that we show the world that we have taken back full control of borders and laws and our seas, but that can't be done with all these grey areas, because no one will then be able to interpret where we are, and our ability to turn around and say this is entirely our decision and our competence will have been taken away from us. It would have been handed away by our own government.
I couldn't disagree with you more, and you've done such a good job of convincing the audience as well. Look, Robert here says she's so pessimistic because she's obviously a Ramona. So you've now gone full circle. You've convinced people that you weren't actually really in the Brexit Party at all, and that you're just this doubtful about Boris Johnson's government, that that's where we've ended up. But Alex, listen, thank you very much indeed. We may be seeing you tomorrow, I understand. We'll talk more about that later on. Alex Phillips reporting in from Tier 2, Gloucester, I should say, political commentator, former Brexit Party MEP. Robert, I can assure you she's not a Ramona. She just doesn't like Boris Johnson's ways of working very much. This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Britain hits back over vaccine, is what it says in the Times. Regulator stands by COVID jab approval. There was a bit of a sort of wobble yesterday, wasn't there, when the American version of our chief medical officer basically came out and said that he gave the impression anyway that working too quickly to find a vaccine that was going to be given out and rolled out for the first people in the world to get it was not exactly the best way of making people feel confident that enough research and enough testing had been done before that happened. They're very certain in this country that has been the case, that they have spent enough time because they've been doing trials alongside one another instead of waiting months in between them, and that's how come things have come out so quickly. But a lot of people have a lot of questions, and let's talk to Professor Carol Sakura now, former head of the World Health Organization Cancer Programme, Dean of Medicine at the University of Buckingham. Carol, a very good morning to you. Welcome.
Morning, Mike. Morning.
Thanks very much indeed for joining us. I mean, I think a lot of the questions that people have are quite legitimate. I think the government has to be careful not to be too kind of, shall we say, overbearing in telling everyone what they must do and why they must do it, because I think that causes people to be even more sort of, I would say, kind of restrictive about their own behaviours and what they would like to do. But shall we start with questions to you, if you don't mind? I don't know whether you'll be able to answer them. But I've got this one from Samantha, who says, could you please ask Professor Carol Sakura what is actually in the vaccine? Nobody seems to be discussing this, and I don't think it's an unreasonable request. Because, of course, no one in the government's told us yet.
It's a very reasonable request. What's in the bottle? You see, yeah. It'll have about half a cubic centimetre of fluid in there, and it'll be drawn in a syringe and put into your arm. And if it's the Pfizer vaccine, what's in the bottle? Well, the most important thing is the message in the bottle. The message being the RNA, which encodes the spike protein. We all know what spike proteins look like. You know the virus, the children draw the virus at school, and those little bobbles are the spike proteins. So what the RNA does is trick our own body, our own muscle, if it's injected into a muscle, to produce little fragments of spike protein. And we do the production. There's no virus, no viral products in the vial of a vaccine, but it makes our own muscle cells produce the protein that in turn stimulates our immune system, and that in turn produces antibodies and T cells and protection.
Yes.
And that's the sequence.
Now, I spoke to a doctor the other day about this, and he said that if you had already had the coronavirus, you should probably still take the vaccine anyway. But surely if you've had the coronavirus, you've got those antibodies anyway, don't you?
You have, but it's we don't really know enough about how long things last in terms of immunity. And that's the big question mark over the vaccine. The vaccine's only been in clinical trial 3 months. So there's no way you know how long it's going to last for. You have to go on for a year, 2 years, 3 years to see how long the protection is. The sort of assumption that everyone's working to is that it's going to be like the flu vaccine. It's not going to be forever. If you take tetanus, one shot of tetanus, and that's it for 10 years. But this is different. This is not a very powerful stimulant of the immune system, and you probably need to renew it time and every year, just like we do for flu. So us oldies get rolled out, get a letter every year, and told, go and have your flu jab. I've been to have mine. And it's slightly different every year because they try and catch up with the mutant flu influenza viruses around, but also you need to boost the system because you gradually lose immunity.
Right. So this type of vaccine then, Carol, is this quite an unusual type of vaccine then, which doesn't actually give you a bit of the disease? Because I always tell people, I remember getting a cholera injection once when I had to go to India many years ago, and I spent a very horrible afternoon sweating and sort of, you know, thinking I was going to die because they'd basically given me cholera, and that was how it felt. But for this, it won't be like that.
It shouldn't be like that. This is really new technology. It's RNA technology. And, you know, the side effects that have been reported from the trials, and it's been into 45,000 people. So, I mean, it's not, it's to half of 45,000 people. And a bit of pain at the site of the injection, a bit of fever sometimes, general bit of grogginess for 24 hours, and then you're fine. In some people, you don't even notice. And different people react differently to all sorts of vaccines.
Yes. Because most people, when they get a flu vaccine, will feel a bit flu-y, won't they?
They do. And, it's the best thing to do is just take it easy, watch television, lie down. Don't try going jogging or things like that. That makes it or playing squash or drinking large amounts of beer. That's probably not a good thing.
No, quite. Now, a couple of other things that have come to my attention have been, to me, unhelpful, if you like, from the point of view of the government's position. Yeah. First of all, they say it's not something that will stop you getting COVID-19, but it will stop you getting very sick with COVID-19. It's also not something that will stop you spreading COVID-19. And it's also now apparently not something which will stop you self-isolating if you get COVID-19. And we've been told by this government right up to the recent week that basically the vaccine is the answer to everything. The vaccine is going to allow us to get back to a normal way of living. But it doesn't sound like that with this particular one.
We just don't know. That's the problem, Mike. We have no idea because it's not been there before. It's been really dramatically pushed through. Some would say too, like Fauci in the United States is having a little dig at the speed at which it's been rolled out in Britain, not Europe, but just Britain. What is amazing is that if it works, we'll then find out, do people that are vaccinated have to isolate? I would suggest probably not in the end, but we have to demonstrate that those that do pass by someone that's heavily infected and therefore definitely a positive contact under the program we have, what is going to happen to them if they've been vaccinated? Do they convert to a positive or not? Yeah. We need to know.
And you've always been an advocate of the size of the viral load being quite important in terms of how sick people get. Does the vaccine have any ability to sort of alter that, if you like?
Again, it's too early to say, but we think so. So from some of the data that's been published, it does look as though not only does it prevent infection, but it also reduces the effect of that infection in terms of viral load and the clinical symptoms you get if you get infected.
Right. I'm under the impression as well that this particular first sort of lot of the vaccine, which we are led to believe is already here and is being distributed, is only going to hospitals rather than going to care homes. Do you know about that?
It's chaos. I can tell you, like, it is chaos.
Is it?
A meeting about it. There's only half the number of vaccine vials have arrived. And remember, you've got to have double the amount for everybody. They've got to come back in 4 weeks or 3 weeks to get the second shot. And then you're not immune for another week after that. So it's a long process. The idea was the care homes, but then who's going to actually do it in the care home? Injecting vaccines is trivial. I mean, you can train a healthcare assistant within an hour to give an effective vaccination. You don't need to have health professionals. You do have to have health professionals standing by in case you get reactions. Mm. So you ideally want a nurse, a doctor to be in the area, but the actual administration is relatively trivial as a procedure. It's not a skilled procedure. So there's enough people ready to do it. The question is all the logistics about collecting the data, identifying the patients, making sure they are who they say they are, all this sort of thing. It's so obvious, but it is time consuming.
Yes.
But, you know, we have a minister that's going to sort it out for us. I don't know what he's doing all day, but this is his problem.
Minister for Vaccinations. Yeah, well, this is the problem. I think part of the problem, and I don't blame the media for being this way, but the media is so focused on coronavirus that literally every single second of every single day, there's another question about it. And there's more scrutiny probably on this than there's ever been on anything in the history of the world. You know, so when you get people asking questions like, for example, how does it affect your fertility? It's not just one question. It's like, well, how does it protect male fertility? How does it affect female fertility? Should you take it when you're pregnant? Should you take it if you're planning to be pregnant? Should you take it if you might want to be pregnant in 5 years? You know, there's a whole myriad of questions.
And the only way we'll get the answers to those, Mike, is to wait, and then we'll collect all the data. And that's important. Surveillance is really going to be important of those people that have it, because we want to know. We want to know all the side effects, from the trivial, short-term, bit of fever immediately after, a bit of tiredness, to longer term. Mm. And obviously it's the long term that really are the important ones. And, you know, we've seen this before. The last round of flu vaccination, the GlaxoSmithKline in 2010, led to a legal action which was settled for £60 million for people getting sleepy after being given the injection. So, and that was only found many years afterwards, and a very rare effect, but definitely connected. So we have to identify all these things.
Well, given what you're saying, Professor, would it have been wiser for the government to have been slightly less enthusiastic about this the other day, rather than them sort of rah-rah banging the drum and saying, we've beaten the world, look at what we've done, we've got the first vaccine, it's going to be great? Because as we've deconstructed it in the last 2 or 3 days, it hasn't seemed quite as great as it did at first glance.
I think you're right. And, you know, what's going to happen on Tuesday, I gather, one of the plans is at 7 o'clock in the morning, all four countries of Britain will simultaneously have someone on camera being injected. This is just PR stunts for politicians. It's of no clinical value whatsoever.
No. Do you think they're drawing straws for it as we speak?
Yeah, exactly. And who's going to be on telly first?
Right.
You know? Will it be Mr. Trump? Will it be Joe Biden? You know, who knows how it's all going to pan out?
Yeah, no, I know. It's interesting. And what about the other question that has come up for me a couple of times from people who are vegans? Is there anything in the vaccine which would prevent a vegan from having it?
I guess there could be a bit of protein in the albumin from a serum in which cells are grown. Although the RNA vaccine is likely to be much cleaner because it's just pure RNA and it doesn't need the protein around it except to stabilize it. But it's a tiny amount. It's like, you know, almost trivial. The sort you get in a, you know, bottle of tomato sauce is a little bit of protein there. Even though vegans take it, there's a little bit of, it's not animal protein, but proteins are coming mainly from animals.
Yeah.
And I guess the other problem for it is abnormal reactions. People do have funny reactions to everything. And, you know, one of my grandchildren is so allergic to everything. You go into a room with a strawberry and he comes out in spots. Mm. I mean, it's And so people do have very stimulated immune systems. It may do them well if they get coronavirus, but it may be a nuisance when they get the vaccine.
Yes. So, that's another question, isn't it, about children and how low down through the age ranges do you go with this vaccine? And I'm also fully aware of the fact that most of these questions will not even need to really be addressed for quite some time, because by the time relatively young and fit people get the vaccine or are offered the vaccine, we're probably going to be talking 9 months to 10 months away, aren't we?
Yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, once we get going, everyone will calm down. I'm looking forward to reading a newspaper that isn't wall-to-wall Corona, and I'm sure you're looking forward to talking about it as well, other things, because it's, and we'll just have to get the vaccine story over. That's next week news. See the Oxford vaccine come. It's a pity that they've lost the boat race here to the Americans, but they may, in the long run, be a much more powerful one, especially internationally, where supply chain are a major issue in terms of cold chain across Africa and so on. So one will win out internationally every time.
Yeah, well, that is the other problem, isn't it? Because of the temperature at which it has to be stored. And as you say, the two-week, the two-shot sort of version of events. And so from what you've said, it would seem that from the first vaccination, you're not in any way vaccinated until you've had a week after the second one.
Exactly. So that's more than a month you have to wait. So there's no quick fix. There was a great film, I don't know if you saw it, called Contagion.
Yeah, I did see. I've watched it several times since the beginning
of
this whole thing.
It's fantastic. It's such a predictive film. It's as though the guys could foresee the future.
I know.
If only the planners in the NHS could have foreseen the future as well, they'd have done well to look.
Well, the other great movie I've watched a lot of is Outbreak as well, which is a bit older.
Yes,
it's a bit more like it's a bit more like Ebola than it is about this. But Contagion is literally just about COVID, isn't it?
It's even called MSV or something like that.
Yeah, well, don't say it too loudly, because people will say, well, this is how we know that it was all planned.
Exactly. And there they had some little nose swabs with the vaccine on. You put the nose swab up the vaccine up the nose.
Yeah.
And the who were sick, they were really ill, would suddenly get up out of the ventilator and be cured just for the fact it doesn't work like that.
No, of course. And let's talk a little bit about the sort of the landscape at the moment as we enter, as I say, we're 3 weeks from Christmas Day, which seems almost impossible to believe that we're that close. But in terms of the way that the vaccine, the virus seems to be at the moment, the numbers seem to be going down. We've got some quite big numbers of reductions in terms of the number of infections. Are you encouraged by that?
Absolutely. And the figure I look at, the single figure to look at, is the number of daily hospital admissions.
Yeah.
And that's falling precipitously. The number of people that are tested positive depends how many you test, it depends what kit you use and all that sort of stuff. That's variable. The people on ventilators is secondary to the number of admissions. So the number of hospital admissions is on a downward curve. I mean, it was about 1,500 last week a day. And this week it's down to 1,200, 1,100 yesterday. So really coming down. And I hope by next week it'll be under 1,000 a day. And that means the NHS is coping really well. It can deal with my specialty, cancer and cardiac and all the other things, because it's not flooded and it's not going to be flooded. What Christmas does, we don't know. And that's, I guess, one of the reasons for trying to roll out the vaccine before Christmas. Just to try and get some partial protection before the inevitability, where there's no way you can keep people apart at Christmas. Everyone can see that.
No.
At least that the politicians know that. And some will obey and some will be much looser with the rules. And we just have to put up with that. And then somehow afterwards, pick up the pieces and go back. But I don't think there'll be a big sort of increase immediately after Christmas. I think it'll die a death then.
Although from what you're saying about the timings of the two vaccinations that you have to have, if you have one, say, next week, the second one you have is not going to be till after Christmas anyway. So you're not going to be protected, as it were, through Christmas, are you?
No, you won't get protection till 2021, even if you got it on Tuesday morning or one of these first people. Four countries to get it. So I think that the way forward is to continue doing what we're doing and to return to some sort of normality in terms of healthcare. That's where we've got to go now.
Is there any chance that this virus might be transmitted in ways that we aren't at the moment aware, for example, in the food chain?
That it's a good point, but we don't think so. And more likely is it with animals, domestic pets,
yeah,
especially the cats, dogs. We heard little snippets about that over the last 6 months, but no good data, thank goodness, because you know what the solution would be if there was evidence of this spreading through dogs or cats.
Right.
And the solution wouldn't be palatable to society, I don't think. So not in Britain anyway, because we love animals.
Well, we saw a story, didn't we, earlier this week, I think, that Boris Johnson's dog supposedly got coronavirus. I don't know how true that was, but, presumably the dog survived.
Yeah, I assume he's still around. And I think, you know, it's interesting. Cats particularly have these RNA viruses, and some of them cause cancer in cats. It's a very bizarre model that's used by cancer researchers to study cancers in cats. So there are all sorts of nuances to come. And, you know, we haven't heard the end of this. There's going to be a lot of feedback from people that have been immunized, and they'll have all sorts of stories to tell us as we go through the early part of 2021.
Right. And what's your sense of how many people will need to be vaccinated and by when for us to kind of confidently say, more or less, that this disease has been eradicated to an extent? Obviously, we won't eradicate it completely, but you've always said that you believe that the virus is actually weakening, and as time goes on, it gets weaker and weaker.
It does, and not only that, significant number of people have already got immunity, even though they haven't been vaccinated, simply because they've had the virus, so they're protected. The more people you protect, the less there is for the virus to infect. So I reckon if we could get 20 million people, that's a third of the population, vaccinated, we'd be at herd immunity, taking into account the fact that some people have already had it, some people have had shared immunity to past coronaviruses, then you get the vaccine coming in. So 20 million sounds trivial, but it's not. It's a huge logistic exercise.
Yes.
And have to do it twice, and then to weigh and to validate that the people have done it. They're going to have to produce an ID. You know, it's not going to be an easy exercise.
No, it has got to be a thought through in a massive way. And that's why I think the government maybe went a little bit early with this very much joyous kind of breakthrough type press conference, which perhaps was a bit early and a bit unwise. But Professor Carol Sakura, as ever, great to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. Former head of the WHO Cancer Programme, Dean of Medicine at the University of Buckingham. We're told, basically, a lot of different things, as ever, with the way that these things are rolled out. The government were very, very excited a few days ago, saying that we'd made the big breakthrough, that we were going to be the first country in the world to approve a vaccine. However, as Professor Carol Sakura just said, it's going to be quite complicated to do all this, right? They need to vaccinate probably, he reckons, 20 million people in order to make it in some way effective. However, it's going to be a month between vaccinations and the two that you need. It's going to be another week after that before you then become protected. And the protection doesn't stop you from getting coronavirus. It just stops you from getting it badly, which I suppose is something. It doesn't stop you giving it to anyone else. It doesn't stop you actually getting it. So, you know, it's not absolutely the sort of the cure-all that it was being sold as being. And also, by the time ordinary people who are not in hospital, who are not suffering and who are not in care homes and who are not vulnerable get it, it'll be quite a long way down the track, won't it?
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham, Talk Radio.
So I put out a tweet last night asking the question of Grant Chaps, precisely what is a high-level businessman of some kind or another, or a high-level businessman of any kind, or businesswoman of any kind? The trending topics on Twitter are still all about the high-value business travellers being exempt from quarantine. Let's find out from Lisa Francesca Nand what it all means. Lisa, very good afternoon to you. Welcome.
Good afternoon.
Now, I think I, like many people, was a bit puzzled. This came a bit out of the blue, didn't it? As if somehow, if you are a high-value business traveller, whatever that is, you don't have to worry about the law.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it, about the high-value business traveller? I mean, how do you justify that? But actually, exemptions from the rule are nothing new. You know, we've always had postal workers, lorry drivers, delivery drivers, anyone working in certain fields like energy, agricultural workers. There's always been people that have been exempt from the travel list, but now they've just added more people. So it is these high value business travellers, some journalists, some sports stars, some professional arts professionals. And the government have said that it will be shortly being announced. We don't really know when that will be on the gov.uk website, exactly what that means. But I'm sure there's lots of people now thinking, how can I make myself out to be a high value business traveller, you know, when I might just be a low value business traveller?
Well, that's it. I mean, they say they're going to be publishing guidelines and they're going to be publishing sort of guidance as well. But I've got already one from Brian here who says, during lockdown, I've been learning to play the spoons. Am I now allowed to travel freely as a member of the arts community per the advice of Grant Shapps? And there's going to be a lot of that, isn't there? Because in terms of business, if the definition of a high-value business traveller is somebody who brings money into the country, you could say that about almost anyone, couldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's going to be a lot of people taking up the spoons, and that would be my major bit of advice right now, is take up spoons playing if you don't play any instruments. Yeah, I think it's, I mean, I don't want to say it's ridiculous. I understand people's complaints that actually you're thinking, well, what about us? Why can't we travel? And there are going to be so few people that actually want to travel at the moment. The only people who do want to travel are those who've got a very good reason for it. But I also get the point of view that, you know, business travellers are very important. They really want to reopen the transatlantic route properly, you know, particularly that London to New York. It's actually very important and it brings in a lot of money to the country. So I kind of see both sides of it. But I have a feeling, you know, they've got the Global Travel Task Force. The government have got this task force. They've been working on it for 2 months now. I have a feeling that very soon, probably by the early January, if not before, that actually they're going to say, okay, quarantine. We realised that travel was a big part in spreading the virus at first, and we don't want to, you know, people to sort of travel and spread it all over the place. However, I've got a feeling they will say, well, actually, no quarantine for everyone, but just sort of increased testing capacity, which is what the travel industry, I might personally, you know, we're hoping for.
Well, that's right. I mean, we saw, didn't we, a United Airlines flight, I think, coming in a few weeks ago from New York to Heathrow, where people were tested just before they got on the plane. But the problem with going backwards and forwards to New York is it's New York at the moment, which would be the impediment to that, because I'm led to believe that New York City, particularly the airports around New York City, are not allowing anyone to come in unless they're American citizens.
Yeah, I mean, the government keep on saying, oh, you can go to this country or that country. In fact, there's not been nothing new on the travel corridor list this week. I think they've been concentrating on this high value business traveller thing. Yeah. They keep saying you can go to this country, but actually the countries are not necessarily letting us in. So we might allow you to go there, but the countries themselves will not let us in. And each country has different rules and regulations about who can get in, whether it's citizens, whether it's someone who's got a, you know, a business meeting or a good enough reason that they can sort of blag to get there. So nobody's going to be going on holiday at the moment for no reason. Well, if there are a few people are, and if anyone is going on holiday, I'd love to know about it, if you're just going to some random country for a bit of sunshine or whatever.
Yeah.
But there's going to be a lot of people who do want to travel for these business reasons, and also for personal reasons like seeing friends and family or getting home, coming back into the country as well.
Well, that's right. I mean, certainly there'll be some people who are going to be going somewhere at Christmas, but that's going to be tricky as well, isn't it? Just to go back to kind of where we are, because we've got this window of opportunity, which the government have very graciously granted us, the 22nd or the 23rd, I think, to the 27th. People are saying to me now, what if we go away and we are away while the 27th comes and goes? What happens then? I mean, are they going to turn around to people and say, you can't get on a train on the 28th or the 29th or the 30th because you've passed the deadline?
The rules are just a little bit ridiculous. And I don't really, you know, blame the government to a certain extent, because they're winging it, you know, like the rest of us. Mm. They've never been in this situation before, and neither have we. But, you know, you've got the whole pub thing, the Scotch egg thing. By the way, I did end up in a pub the other day on the first day, and they did actually give me a Scotch egg, not
That's
a veggie
good.
One, because I am a vegetarian. So I was pleased to actually get the Scotch egg. But yeah, I mean, I don't know what they're doing at the moment, but I do hope, I think this is a step in the right direction. And I think that, you know, lifting quarantine completely would probably be the way to go, and probably is going to be the way to go. But you're right, there'll be so many people saying, well, what about about us? Are we not a, you know, are we not a valued traveller? Why can't we travel at the moment? So there'll be a lot of disappointment. If you were going to book a flight or a holiday right now, there must be so many people thinking, as you said, what happens if it's coming back after the 27th? What are they going to change the rules while I'm away? If I was personally planning to go somewhere at the moment, I'd be tempted to actually book it and think that by the time I get back, you know, the quarantine situation is going to be different. Although as it stands at the moment, if you're not on this list or can't blag your way onto this list, you will still either have to do the 14 days or do the 5 days and pay 150 quid, I think, in some instances, to take your own test, private test at the end of those 5 days to get out of it. So that seems pretty unfair. You know, you're a business traveller, you can go, come back, don't have to do anything. You want to go on holiday, you can't be, you know, become a business traveller, you have to pay 150 quid to get the test.
Yes, and I mean, I presume in order to qualify to be a high-end business traveller, you have to apply in some way, shape or form to do that. And until we see the criteria, we just don't know whether we're going to be able to fit it.
I'm guessing that you will still have to fill in the passenger locator form. Everyone coming back in the country has to fill in this form. So I'm guessing it's up to you what you put on that form. I've filled in those forms and it was up to me, you know, because I'm a journalist and I was thinking at the time, you know, could I get away with, you know, saying I was on essential duty. I'm hardly Kate Ady. I'm not out reporting on, on war crises or anything like that. So I'm probably not essential. So I told the truth and you know, did the quarantine. Who's going to be checking it? That's the thing, isn't it? Who's going to be checking that people going into a restaurant are going to be having a business meeting, which you are allowed to have, or that you're actually living together? Are people going to be IDing you? You know, we're not, we don't live, luckily, I would say, in a country like that. Police aren't necessarily stopping us regularly on the streets and checking our ID and going through, you know, the passenger locator form and actually saying, you know, looking at your accounts, are you a high business, a high value business person? I don't think they're going to go into those that much detail, but it all depends how honest you are and how, you know, risk averse you are. And I think the majority of people will think, well, actually, you know, that probably isn't me as a high value business person, and I probably won't, you know, lie on a government form.
No, and also, you know, if you're traveling with sort of a couple of screaming children and obviously very irritable husband, they're not going to think you're on. Not that I'm describing your travel at all, Lisa, but you know, people are going to go, well, she's clearly not working. You know, that's the thing. But I mean, equally, we're told as well that they're going to be doing away with all sorts of rail replacement bus services. They're going to be putting coaches on for people who want to travel around Britain around Christmas time. They're not going to do a load of road works in order to keep it all moving. But it sounds like it's going to be a bit of a gridlock situation.
It's very interesting. I mean, it's always a bit of a gridlock situation anyway when people head off to Christmas at the same time. So, I mean, I don't know. I was on the streets of London for the first time in months the day that all the Wednesday, wasn't it, when everything reopened.
Yeah.
And it was quiet compared to normal, but there was still traffic queues. So I think people will leave, you know, at their own time and sort of allow for delays and that sort of thing, just like any other Christmas. But I'm imagining it's not going to be as busy as normal, because life isn't back to normal yet, is it? You know, whether that's traveling, the airports are still empty, you know, there hasn't been a big rush on them at the moment for the Christmas, big Christmas getaway like usual.
Right, although we saw Ryanair yesterday ordering a load of planes, which I thought was rather unusual, because I mean I know Ryanair's been very kind of good at trying to keep going through the whole pandemic, and they've probably flown more than a lot of other airlines, but for them to make such a big investment was kind of encouraging in a way.
I think it was encouraging, yes. And I mean, certainly, maybe they know something we don't. Certainly travel or, you know, will reignite. The economy will hopefully get back to normal at some point. Maybe they had them ordered before and they were still going to get them anyway. But the whole airline thing, it's a very personal thing. You know, we had Qantas last week saying that they were saying that they'll have proof of vaccination before you actually get on a flight. And I can imagine someone like Ryanair and Michael O'Leary actually coming out, you know, he's so gung-ho about things, actually coming out and saying something similar at some point. We just don't know what is going to happen.
No, quite. And do you expect there to be any more kind of movement on different countries and different air corridors? I know that quite a lot of people are looking at the Caribbean as a place that they could possibly go. People are looking at sort of Southeast Asia again as a place they could go if they wanted to sort of last minute trip. And I'm not talking about something that needs a lot of organisation, you know, but just the sort of a Christmas away type thing.
Well, again, a lot of these destinations on the travel corridor list, you know, are not letting us in. So that's something to check before you actually book somewhere. You know, they're actually one-way corridors, some of them. There were no new travel corridors announced this week. I think travel corridors, the concept of it, is about to sort of peter out because this quarantine, you know, the issue is about people not being able to go there because they're going to quarantine when they get back. And I think the quarantine issue is the one to watch at the moment. And I'm certainly, you know, waiting with bated breath. I'm checking Grant Shapps' Twitter feed all the time because he just announced this at 8 o'clock last night, and we're all like, okay, well, that's interesting. We didn't necessarily know that was coming.
No.
So yeah, travel corridors, nothing new announced this week. Kind of, I think they're going to end up a little bit, you know, redundant at some point if this quarantine, the releasing of quarantine, and you know, the relaxing it, if that continues to happen.
Yes, and interesting as well about Qantas. I thought we should give them a mention before we let you go, because they came out quite early on, about a week or two ago, saying they wouldn't allow anyone to fly on their planes who hadn't had a vaccine. But the vaccine now that we're told is going to be given out doesn't actually stop you spreading the disease, doesn't actually stop you getting it, and doesn't stop you self-isolating. So I think they might have gone a bit early on that.
Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting thing. It was the CEO of Qantas that said it, and that Qantas is an Australian airline. Australian have had a very significant lockdown. They're still not letting people come in and out the country. If you do go in, if you have to have a very good reason to go in, you do 14 days in a hotel, courtesy of the government. So I think it was a very brave thing to say, actually, because there's a lot of people who will say, well, I'm not going to get that airline. But travel is a choice as well, isn't it? It's not an obligation. And actually something ridiculous, like only 3% of the world's population take aeroplanes. You know, we're kind of privileged in this country because we're kind of used to sort of hopping on a plane. So whether other airlines will follow suit with the vaccination thing, I don't know. I don't think they will, because, you know, it's only going to be the old people at first that get vaccinated. Yeah. So what, they're going to not have young people on the flights? You know, we don't know anything about private vaccinations at the moment. I've been trying to do some research on that, and I'm sort of drawing blanks at the moment as to whether you can actually go out and buy yourself a vaccine.
I don't think you can at the moment.
No,
I think at
can't.
The moment, the only vaccines that we have are the ones that are available in hospitals.
Yes, exactly. So what, the Qantas are only going to let people over 80 fly? I mean, they're talking about spring, when presumably the vaccine will be rolled out to a lot more people, but it still is not going to reach anyone. I don't know if it'll ever reach people like me in their 30s and 40s, you know, who are supposedly healthy and fit and everything like that. So I don't think they can get away with that, you know, unless you can start buying it privately again. And then there's the whole thing a bit that, like, people are complaining about now, is that only the rich and the elites are allowed to travel and not to come back and, you know, pay that 150 quid for a test. So, yeah.
Yes, it's an interesting landscape. Lisa, listen, great Christmas tree, by the way. I think you're the first person who's done a Zoom call with us with a tree in the background. Very nicely done. We should give you a prize of some kind. Thank you
Absolutely.
Very much. Lisa Francesca Nando reporting into us with Christmas tree and festive greetings. I said it was going to be a bit of a festive show. We've got Christmas trees up here in the office, not quite in the studio, but we may have an odd Christmas tree or two tomorrow when we bring you the show live right here on Talk Radio from 10 o'clock, myself and Kevin O'Sullivan.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We're with you until 1 o'clock. Of course, the Perrier Awards coming up very shortly with Marta Maligon. I think it's been a pretty good week for them. Hopefully, we will see how well I have done or otherwise. Right now, though, we're going to do something rather interesting, because everybody talks about Bluetooth. Everybody who got the NHS app would understand that they were going to be contacted by the NHS app if they were in vulnerable sort of territory, having been close to somebody thanks to their Bluetooth device. We also, of course, use it for all manner of other things, transmitting pictures, listening to music, making sure that your phone works properly in the car. Let's talk to Thomas Crick, Professor of Digital Education and Policy at Swansea University. Thomas, a very good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Mike. How are you doing?
Yeah, very well indeed. I'm looking forward to this conversation, because everybody uses Bluetooth, but I would bet you any money nobody really understands it. I certainly don't. How does it work?
No, so I suppose we're aware of our kind of connected world, our connected devices. We're used to things just kind of seamlessly working together, and you switch it on and it connects and syncs.
Right.
So Bluetooth has been around for a long time. It was basically designed as a wireless kind of standard to replace kind of standard kind of cable connections, sort of data cable connections. It was proposed in the early 1990s, and the first devices started to ship in 1999. And maybe we're all used to the classic Bluetooth headset, which was a classic kind of early 2000s style icon image.
Yes, it was. And was it the sort of the precursor to wireless Wi-Fi, if you like?
Well, so it's a different frequency range. So it's low power and kind of it's an ultra high frequency band, which is an unlicensed band. So anyone is free to kind of use this, which is usually used for industrial kind of scientific and medical devices. Mm. And essentially, I suppose it's electromagnetic radiation. So it does kind of propagate in the same way, but largely quite short distances. And I suppose it's used for kind of pairing up digital devices to exchange data.
Right. And I mean, is it something that is static in terms of its development? I mean, will it get better? Can it get better at what it does, more efficient?
So largely, it's kind of a mature technology because it's been around since the late 90s.
Right.
There have been various levels and kind of, you know, new iterations and versions of the Bluetooth standard. But essentially what we have now is kind of, you know, it does a specific task. You know, we think about the kind of our world, the kind of Internet of Things. And I think the COVID app is a good example of where we can kind of compare and contrast and kind of work out when devices kind of come near each other. We can exchange data between, you know, broadly sort of 10 meter distances at a max. But it's, you know, essentially there are other devices and other kind of technologies, you know, 4G, 5G, which are probably better suited to kind of sharing some of, you know, if we're talking about kind of connecting up our world.
Yes. I mean, I don't tend to use it for sending things to other people. I don't tend to use it for, you know, collecting information as such. As you say, it's more about, you know, if I'm playing some music on in my car, it's going to connect to the car system from the phone, that kind of thing. So who sort of came up with Bluetooth? Is there a person that you could say he invented Bluetooth?
Well, so it was named after Harald Bluetooth, the 10th century Danish king.
Great
essentially,
name.
I know exactly. So it was named after it was developed by Ericsson in the early 90s,
okay.
And then I suppose there was an international consortium of major kind of telecoms and microprocessor companies who maintain the Bluetooth kind of international standard.
Okay.
But essentially it has been around. You know, it's one of those things where we hear about it, we see the Bluetooth symbol, we expect it to kind of work seamlessly, and we don't. You know, I suppose we never, and until it's impossible to kind of sync devices, we get very frustrated. It's a part of our digital world.
Yes, and I mean Ericsson. There's a name from the past. I mean, I think I remember I used to have an Ericsson phone back in the early days of mobile phones. It was a little blue one, I think, actually. What's happened to them? Are they still going?
Yeah, so Ericsson have essentially moved out of the kind of consumer, kind of mobile telephone technologies. They do a lot of the back end kind of backhaul stuff. So actually Ericsson are one of the major global suppliers of 5G infrastructure. So they're probably part of the UK's 5G back end.
Oh, right. So we could use them instead of Huawei then?
So that has been, I mean, the problem is with that, there are only three major suppliers. And if you take one of them out, you've got a lot of critical dependency. But yeah, Ericsson are one of the major suppliers.
Okay. And as far as the kind of security of something like Bluetooth, because everybody worries about, you know, data being mined by other people or for people who might use it for nefarious purposes, is it pretty secure?
It hasn't always been as secure as we'd like in the past. There have been phrases such as bluejacking, where you could intercept kind of Bluetooth kind of communications, particularly if you're sharing data or images or whatever, or you could remotely take over the phone. But that's why the various iterations of the Bluetooth standard has addressed some of the kind of security considerations. But as always with wireless standards, this is always a concern around the kind of end-to-end encryption piece, or how do we maintain the security of these connections.
Yeah, because I think people always wonder about whether you should switch it on when you want to use it, or and then just switch it off the rest of the time. I mean, I think most people are pretty lazy. They just put, if it's on, it's on, you know.
No, exactly. And I think, as you mentioned before, the use of the NHS kind of COVID-19 app has really kind of raised people's awareness of if it can be used for that type of reason, then actually it's quite easy to monitor people with their digital devices.
Mm. And that's what people worry about, isn't it? Because they don't want to be monitored.
No, and I suppose that it's interesting when you see kind of, you know, city landscapes or kind of, you know, areas offering free Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
It's actually very easy to, you know, with high definition CCTV and being able to kind of ping people off of public Wi-Fi, it's very easy to monitor people over an urban landscape.
Yeah, no, indeed. And as far as the use of it is concerned, is it available everywhere? Do you have, I mean, is there a part of the world you go to where there isn't any Bluetooth?
No, I mean, I suppose, luckily, I mean, partly because of this UHF kind of radio band is an unlicensed standard. So essentially, no one controls it. You know, as we've auctioned off certain parts of the spectrum in the past for 3G and 4G, this specific part of the band is used for low power, kind of low distance application, so it's perfectly fine for, you know, so essentially it's available throughout the world, just depending on if you've got devices that are Bluetooth capable.
And do people have to pay for it? I mean, like, if you were, say, Vodafone, do you have to somehow license the use of it? Or if you're a telecommunications company, so that, in other words, you know, Ericsson's making 5p every time I send myself a song.
Yeah, so essentially, if you have a Bluetooth compatible device, then you would have obviously paid for the Bluetooth chipset, and then to use the brand or use the technology, there is probably some license back to the original owners of the Bluetooth patents and technologies. Yeah.
Okay. And as far as these kinds of things go, is there anything sort of? I know this is a $64,000 question. Is there anything kind of in the pipeline which is going to change the way that we communicate with each other?
Well, we mentioned 5G before. I mean, I think that's where you see this kind of next generation, and it's going to be a lot of kind of hybrid technologies to kind of connect stuff together. But as we move to this world of, you know, a multitude of connected devices, the smart home, smart infrastructure, Internet of Things, then 5G is supposed to replace that, because it's shorter distance but higher bandwidth. Mm. So actually, you can do these high, you know, extremely high powerful applications. And that's what people expect now. You expect to be able to get kind of bandwidth and connectivity wherever we are in the world.
Yes. Well, after 6 o'clock tonight, of course, you'd be hard pushed to find yourself able to get to a pub and have a drink. So you may have to Bluetooth yourself a pint of some kind.
True, exactly.
Absolutely. Thomas, thanks for talking to us. Thomas Crick, Professor of Digital Education and Policy. So now you know all you need to know about Bluetooth. Quite fascinating, isn't it? Named after an old king somewhere in Scandinavia. Who knew there was a King Bluetooth? This is Talk Radio.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
It's Friday, it's 12:45, and it's time for this.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Perrier Awards.
Still not quite full compliance.
I don't know what else I'm going to do.
I know. I mean, you're going to threaten them with something, maybe.
I already have.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Maybe I just need to turn it up a notch.
I think so. Welcome.
Welcome. And good afternoon.
Thank you.
And welcome again.
Yes.
To the Perrier Awards.
Yes.
This is where we look back over the past week of the so-called Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio and choose our favourite moments. This week, I have to say, you win loads of them.
Do I?
Yes.
Well, you see, that's a good thing.
It is a really good thing.
Yeah. I mean, I was a bit sort of mixed up at times this week. I don't quite know why that was. I think it's because it's nearly the end of the year.
I think so. Yeah. We're all a bit tired.
It's been a long haul.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, well.
I've only been to the Isle of Wight once for a small break.
Yes. Fair.
And we've got another big show tomorrow.
We've got another big show tomorrow. Yes. Yeah, that's going to be really exciting.
It's going to be very exciting coming from our brand new studio where we did the US election, which we like a lot.
And I've heard it's looking great.
Is it?
Yeah. Got some insight.
We've got some surprises in store.
We've got a few surprises in store, yeah.
Great.
The only thing I can tell you for sure is it'll be 10 to 1 as usual.
Excellent.
And it'll be with Kevin O'Sullivan.
Yes.
That's all we can say for now.
Yeah, that's all we know, in fact.
Well, yeah.
And lots of guests.
Yes,
obviously.
Loads of guests, yeah. Fag with guests. Anyway,
yes.
Tradition says the first Perry goes to you, Mike.
Thank you.
It's the rodent chat of the week.
Coming up, we may be seeing Boris Johnson. At the moment, I'm looking at a small rodent crawling into a river. So it's definitely not him yet.
Yeah.
I'm not sure it was a rodent, actually.
I couldn't possibly
Technically
know.
Technically speaking, I don't know if that's characterised as being a rodent, but I couldn't actually say what it was.
No.
For obvious reasons.
Absolutely not.
Thank God I didn't.
No. Make your guesses at home.
Yes.
We'll never tell you.
There we are. It's got big teeth. It's very furry.
Mike, you win another Perrier, this time for the aggressive moment of the week. Mm.
The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham. I just punched the microphone there as I feel particularly aggressive today. I didn't mean to.
I know you didn't. But, you know, sometimes it happens. It's the
it
news,
does.
Isn't it?
It is. It's just one of those things.
Yeah.
Half of the course.
Oh, well. And yet another Perrier for you.
Another
honestly,
one.
It's
this
ridiculous.
It's the first time I've had three in a row, I think.
Yes, I think it might happen again. It's the apology of the week.
I've often been accused of banging on a bit too much, and I'm afraid I'm guilty of, as charged, of banging on way too long in that opener, but I'm terribly sorry. It's just there was an awful lot to say. I was getting funny looks from you guys, that's why I felt like I had to justify myself. Mark was wondering when it was all going to end.
Well, yeah, I think it is possible that the bed, so the bed, when we talk about the bed in radio terms, yes. we mean the music that would yes. play underneath your voice.
Right.
So
it runs out eventually.
It runs out eventually. And there have been like a handful of occasions in which we had to play it three times.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
I think so. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah. It sometimes just goes like that, you know. I don't always plan it.
Yeah.
Well, in fact, I never plan it.
No, of course not.
But sometimes there's just a lot to say.
I know.
You know.
I know. And this week there's been a lot going on. But anyway, I do appreciate you apologising for it. And you've definitely been accused of banging on too much.
That's true. That's what I get paid for.
Well, exactly.
It's my job.
You've made a career out of it. So, hey-ho,
yes.
who's winning here?
Well, some people call it a career.
Well, yeah.
I'm not sure.
Well, I'll tell you who's winning, Perry, for the first time,
I think.
It's newsreader Amelia Cox. She makes it to the list this week for the confusion moment of the week.
Lastminute.com's agreed to pay £7 million to more than 9,000 customers who haven't received holiday refunds. The legal deadline's 2 weeks ago. A week, 2 weeks.
Hmm? What does it mean?
2 weeks ago, a week ago, 2 weeks.
2 weeks ago. Yeah. Well,
I don't know.
Yeah, me neither.
That's why it's the confusing.
Okay, I'm confused.
Yeah, and unfortunately I've got no answers. And she's not in today, so we can't ask her.
Well, never mind.
So, you know.
If you were going to get a refund, I guess you've already had it.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, or you should have applied for it already.
2 weeks ago.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago from the day that this bulletin was broadcast, which was not today. So.
No. Okay.
I don't know what to tell you. This week's Out of Context Perry Reward is a fantastic insight into Mike Graham's life.
I had a leg of lamb at the weekend, right? Which was one of the greatest things I've ever tasted in my life. That's true. It was that good.
Did you make it yourself?
I didn't actually cook it myself, no. Mm-hmm. No, it was cooked by somebody else.
Fair enough.
But they were part of the family.
Yes. So, oh, that's fine.
Yeah.
That's
well, originally fine. We wanted to cook it slowly.
Yeah.
And then we realised we'd run out of time. So we just cooked it quickly.
Fair enough.
You know, we've had these conversations with Ian Collins about the slow cooker. I don't think you can get a whole leg of lamb into the slow cooker, but we didn't have a slow cooker.
No, because it's quite big, isn't it?
It is, yeah, really big. But the idea was that we were going to cook it really, really slowly and have it kind of Greek style in pizza bread and stuff like that. But then we didn't have enough time.
That's nice.
But it was very good.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad it was good.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you.
Mail on Sunday columnist and a friend of the show, Pete Hitchens, wins a Perrier for the delay of the week.
Time to say a very good morning to Peter Hitchens of the Mail on Sunday. Peter, hello, how are you? Are you there, Peter?
Yes, I am.
You are, welcome. Sorry, I thought we missed you there for a second. Yes, he said he'd forgotten to press the unmute button.
No, that wasn't him.
Wasn't that him?
That was someone else.
Oh, was it? All right.
But we'll get to that in a minute.
I've jumped the gun.
Yes, we're going to take a detour
to
Julia Holly Breakfast now. Mm. Now, I don't have time to explain this, but there's a thing called the morning round of guests.
Yes.
It's very complicated.
Alistair Stewart explains it very well.
He explained it very well. Yeah, he did. Maybe I should have replayed the clip of him. But basically, in a nutshell, means that every morning, Julia speaks to someone from the government and the opposition. Most days.
Yes.
Pretty much every day. So earlier in the week, she spoke to Shadow Education Secretary Kate Green.
Yes.
And she won a Perrier for her impression of a Robert in a cupboard.
Happening in our schools and what's going to happen in particular with GCSE and A-level exams coming up next summer. What's your major concern?
Well, I'm concerned, Julia, from their parents.
Kate, I'm so sorry to interrupt. The line has suddenly gone very strange. It sounds like you're sort of a robot in a cupboard.
Robot in a cupboard?
Yeah. She nailed that one.
That sounds like Canary in a Coal Mine. It's a line from a police song.
It is.
A robot in a cupboard.
Yeah.
I like it.
Well, listen.
Mm. Maybe Sting can write a song about it.
Maybe. Yeah. Don't send him an email.
No.
No?
No, don't do it.
Send him an email. And from breakfast to afternoons with Ian Collins, I'm beginning to suspect Ian has a secret obsession with animal chat. Yesterday, he won a Perrier for the bold statement of the week.
Lay my cards on the table, and this is a very personal view of chickens, but I hate chickens. I like the taste of chicken, but I think they're ridiculous. Honestly, I've never quite worked out the role in the evolutionary cycle of your chicken.
Well, it's obviously for food, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I guess so.
He likes eating them.
Yeah.
If you didn't have a chicken to eat, you might starve and die, and that would be the end of him.
Yeah.
Evolution-wise.
Yes.
You know, because he does eat a lot of chicken.
Ian?
Yeah.
Gosh, yeah, he's obsessed.
He does. Yeah. He still hasn't told me about his ninja cooker, by the way.
Ninja?
I think it's called a ninja cooker, yeah. He says he's going to tell me about it today.
Well, it could be that. He should be in about 45 seconds. So if you're listening, okay. Ian, it's time for you to come in. It's time also as well for the classic, oops, Mike forgets how to speak again.
Welcome back to the Independent Republic of Mike Graham right here on Talk Radio. We've been, what's the word? I've completely forgotten the word now. I was going to say marauding around. I think I meant meandering. That's what I meant to say.
Probably.
That's not good, is it?
It's not
good.
There
are times, though, when it happens. It just happens.
Listen, it happens, and this week we are so blessed. Thank the Lord. We actually have a second incident.
All right. And we've got a bit of baking for you, too, before the end of the show. You're listening to me, Mike Graham, right here on the fastest-growing radio station. Fastest-growing radio show on the fastest-growing radio station. That'll do. Yes. That's enough.
It's difficult.
It is. It's really difficult. It's like I said, I say a lot of words. I don't know how many every single week. You know, it's probably the equivalent of War and Peace.
Yes.
You know, and it's not surprising I get a few wrong.
When these little things happen, do you know that I'm going to stitch you up and put them in the Paris?
Well,
on
usually
Fridays.
I can tell by the way you throw your hands in the air like you've just won the Champions League. It's a bit of a giveaway.
This is really funny.
So
you know?
Occasionally I hope that you haven't noticed. But, you know,
no, I always notice. Always listening. And you alluded to this earlier, but Conservative MP Matt Vickers wins this week's James Larvin Perry Award for Technical Failure.
Which is, to some extent, lockdown number three. Matt, a very good morning to you. Welcome. Hello, Matt. Are you there?
Good morning, Mike. I'm there. I've done that thing that everybody does on every Zoom call and forgets to unmute themselves.
Yeah, not everybody, actually, Matt.
Well, no.
Most people manage to do it promptly.
Yeah, but not the Prime Minister. So, hey,
yeah,
he's got an excuse there. He's got an excuse. And finally, Mike, many congratulations. You win a Perry for the worst kept secret of the week.
But coming up in the next hour, we're going to be doing a lot more to do with the coronavirus, because we are going to be joined by one of our very friendly and expert medical experts, but I'm not going to tell you who yet. It's Dr. Waqar Rashid. Okay, I will tell you.
What was that about?
I think I might have forgotten who it was and then spotted it, which can also sometimes happen.
Yeah.
The person's name just goes out of your head and then you go, oh, there it is.
And then you're like, oh, there it is.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. That made me laugh out loud.
Yes.
Even when I was editing that clip, I was laughing like an idiot. So thank you on behalf of the audience and myself. And that's all for the Perrier Awards. There'll be more next week.
The Perrier Awards on Talk Radio.
Talk Radio. Across the UK, online, on DAB, and on your smart speaker. The Independent Republic of Mike Graham on Talk Radio.
If you enjoyed that, be sure to catch the whole show 10 till 1, Monday to Friday, on Talk Radio via DAB, online, or via the Talk Radio app. And if you have an opinion on the stories we cover, we'd love to hear from you. Call us on 0344 499 1000 or tweet at Talk Radio during the show to have your say.
Mid-morning with Mike Graham. Talk Radio.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.